They'll praise your strength while wondering out loud how they themselves would handle it. This happened a lot in those last few days. I heard it all. I don't know how you do it. I couldn't imagine. I don't know if I'd be able to go through that. I know people weren't being shitty. I know they weren't making my very soon-to-be dead father all about them. But people can't help it. It's just what we do. My answer to all of them was the same, very simple. Don't. Don't spend 1 second playing that out. Don't imagine anything. Don't put yourself in my position. Just call your dad. If you're pissed off, call him. If you're busy, call him. If you hung out yesterday but miss him today, call your dad. And if he doesn't pick up, leave a message and let him know you were thinking about him. I couldn't remember the last time my dad and I talked or what we actually said to each other, but I do know that I didn't say goodbye, at least not in any way that would have meant anything. And it kills me. Even today, those last few months when he was alive were a gift I left unopened. I didn't have what it took to walk that road with him. I knew that the next part of me to break was going to be broken forever, so I walked away. I couldn't tell him how hurt I was. I couldn't put that on him. I was young, and I wasn't ready for any of it. I play those last few months out of my head all the time, and how today I would have done it all so differently. I would empty my bank account to find him the best care at home. I would find a place in the country with no neighbors and windows that opened. He deserved to go out with morning sun on his face and wet feet from sitting on the porch in one last rainstorm. I would take one of those hands of his, the ones that could fix anything, and hold it against my chest every night until he fell asleep. I wouldn't force him to get up and walk, but I would ask him to dance. I would beg him to finish telling all the stories that still had holes and felt incomplete. The ones without endings. The ones I was now going to have to tell for him. My dad had this Roadrunner belt buckle that he always used to show off when I was a kid. I was fascinated with it. It wasn't anything fancy. It didn't look like it cost more than a couple bucks, but I knew it meant something to him. I don't remember a lot of stuff actually meaning much to my dad, but this did. I hadn't thought about that belt buckle in over 20 years, but for some reason, as he was lying there dying, I couldn't get it out of my head. I wondered what happened to it, where it went. I used to think it was the coolest thing, and I remember asking to borrow it one time for a costume I was putting together for school. He told me no for the first time in my life. The story behind it meant more than the buckle itself, but that little piece of tin with a cartoon Roadrunner hammered into it was all that was left of whatever he did to earn it. In the Marines, everybody got a nickname. Dad's was Roadrunner because he said, "Nobody could ever catch me." Like most of his stories, that one evolved over the years too, but I'm not sure he ever finished it. I'm not sure I ever got the whole truth behind the Roadrunner. My dad was never proud and never bragged about anything he did in the Marines, but this was different, and I'm still not sure why. That's all I could think about that day, that belt buckle and the unfinished story behind it. The lung floor of any hospital is a different place from all the other floors. Most people on a lung floor are dying prematurely from totally preventable deaths. Every hallway, bathroom, and waiting area reeks of cigarette smoke. It's filled with dying 60-year-olds who look 80, with most of their friends and family looking the exact same. I was a great smoker. Even after both my lungs collapsed a few years earlier, I was still a great smoker. I was ticking like crazy and fighting off panic attacks. I couldn't smoke in Dad's room, so I'd sip on a pre-mixed bottle of vodka and orange juice that I kept in the bottom of my bag. Drinking always helped with my tics and anxiety. Or maybe I just cared less when I was half drunk. I'd go from wanting to be there right by his side to needing an escape. From wanting to make every second last to wanting it all to be over. One minute I promised myself I was never going to let go of his hand, and the next I was making every possible excuse to go and do anything else. I'd go on coffee runs or pretend I had to pee so I could hide in a bathroom to stand beside a urinal and cry. Then I'd smoke. I'd take the elevator down 3 flights and walk out to the sidewalk to sit and smoke with dying addicts. I'd smoke with people wearing robes and slippers in wheelchairs with oxygen tanks attached to the back. I'd put on my headphones and listen to Pink Moon by Nick Drake two or three times, and we'd smoke in the rain. This somehow made me feel better about myself, and I'm sure, in some fucked up way, it made them feel better about themselves too. You'd think walking back up to the lung floor smelling like wet cigarettes would be frowned upon, but it was the farthest thing from that. You could hear people take in deep breaths as you walk by. I wasn't gross or some reminder of bad decisions. The exact opposite, actually. To them, I was delicious. I smelled like home. After one of my long smoke breaks, I walked back into Dad's room and found myself alone with him. Rich and Leanna were off getting food, Taylor was probably with them, and I'm sure my mom was out on the phone updating friends or somewhere catching her breath. It wasn't for long, but me and my pops were alone. After the DNR was signed, I stopped asking questions about recovery and procedures. I had no interest in what happened next or how long Dad had. The only question I remember asking was, can he still hear me? The doctor replied, yeah, I'm sure he can. Talk to him. But what do you say? How do you even come up with the last thing you'll ever say to someone? All I wanted to do was hear his laugh. I didn't want to say anything to him, but I wanted to hear everything. I wanted him to snap up and tell me where he'd been these last few days and whether it was beautiful. I wanted him to open his eyes and say something funny. I wanted that awkward high five followed by a kiss on the forehead he'd always give me, sometimes for doing something great, but most times for no reason at all. I knew this was going to be my last time alone with him. I knew this was it. I'm sure he did too. I couldn't fix him or make any of this better, but I owed him something. I just had to be the fucking kid he raised. The words I said would be a direct reflection of him, all his hard work, advice, and sacrifice. I pulled my chair in close, rested my head on his chest, and said, Happy birthday, Merry Christmas, I love you, and good night. Which were all the things I knew he'd miss hearing the most. Those four things, said with a kiss on the forehead, were always guaranteed to light him up. That was my dad, and that was the last thing I ever said to him. When it was time to say goodbye, when his body fought like hell for that last breath, my mom gave that moment to me and my brother. We climbed into bed with him, me on Dad's left and Rich on his right. Mom stood at the bottom of the bed, rubbing his feet. She didn't move, break down, or say a single word. She was built for this, and she knew this was the way my pops would want to go. Exactly like that. That was the day that hollowed me out. And it was perfect. Good night, Roadrunner. Funeral close. Truth is, I have no idea when my dad died or how long it's been, and I don't want to know either. The day I said goodnight to him was the day I stopped counting time. I never wanted to be reminded. I refused to acknowledge the anniversary and still avoid all reminders and conversations that would timestamp it. I simply don't ever want to know when I hit the point where I've lived more life without him than I did with him. How long does it take to get over someone you love dying? Years ago, my answer was always the same. I don't know. I don't know if anyone knows, but I'll let you know when it happens. Today, my answer to that question is forever. For as long as my dad is dead and I'm still alive, it's going to hurt. It never gets better, but it does get easier. We know how to handle death when it happens to someone else. We bake a lasagna, break out our funeral clothes, and offer whatever you need. We know how to be there for people, even when it's the first time. Instinct takes over, and we put a few words together from the heart, even though they're not even close to being enough. But they don't have to be. We don't have to do it all, because that's what all the other people are for. To build a net and make sure the person suffering doesn't fall too hard. There's no timeline for grieving, and it's something we all have to do at our own pace. Generally, people give you whatever time and space you need, even if they've never gone through it themselves. They get it, and there's an understanding that people just need time. What everyone has difficulty with, however, is when someone climbs out of that net too soon. We know how to handle someone who's hurting. We don't know how to handle someone who should be hurting but isn't. I was that person for a very long time. I took an extra week off work after my dad's funeral because I thought people would think me and my pops had a shit relationship if I went back too soon. Like somehow, 5 extra days off would make some huge difference, but it did. To them, not to me. And when I did make it back to work, I made sure I looked sad enough that people knew I had a heart, but not so sad that I made anyone uncomfortable. When you finally make your way back into the life you left, most people you know will ask the same well-meaning question. How are you doing? It's simple, doesn't ruin your day, and usually comes from a good place. You can answer that question 1,000 different ways, but what you can't say is, I don't know, it hasn't hit me yet, and just carry on. I cared too much about protecting other people from my pain, and way too much about what I'd eventually have to do to pay back whatever support came my way. Everything was about balance. I told myself never to take more than I'd be able to give back. I had nothing to give and couldn't see myself ever being able to return any of the goodwill or kindness that people seemed so eager to lend. So I left all offers on the table. I didn't trust people when they said that it was no problem or they were happy to help and do whatever. I looked at support like a loan or favor banking. I was skeptical, paranoid, and hollow. Every night after work, I'd head to the Black Bull Tavern on Queen West. The Bull was one of those loud, established in 1800-something rock and roll pubs, filled with thick smoke, thick blue-collar bikers, and a stacked staff of hard women who could more than handle their own. The Bull wasn't the toughest place, but just like the women who ran it, it could be when it needed to be. This was my church. I'd go to fit in and disappear, always sitting on the last stool around the back corner of the dark, sticky, carved-up hardwood bar. I'd always have a notebook and a few pens with me, so it seemed like I had some creative or artsy reason to be there alone every night, but the truth is, nobody cared. Half the other people were in there alone. I'd see the same guys every night, usually older, ghostly-looking men who'd flirt with the bartenders while nursing the same beer for an hour before they'd drift home to whatever they'd been avoiding, or to the next bar, hoping another drink would be the one that fixed everything. We were the exact same. I'd leave work to sit in the dark and in my own head, surrounded by strangers. Sometimes I'd manage to write a few notes, or a song lyric, or a bit of what resembled poetry. Then I'd rip the pages out of my book and throw them in the garbage by the front door on my way out. I took nothing with me. Mostly, I'd dive. I've always had the ability to check out or zone out, whatever you want to call it. I can find a spot on a wall or out a window, anything that catches my eye, really. Lock onto it, staring a hole through whatever it is, and dive. I don't black out, but I can easily lose 15, 20, or sometimes 25 minutes doing this. Doing nothing while silently building a case against every decision I'd ever made. I was listing my mistakes and losing count. "Hey, where'd you go?" said a voice that finally broke my concentration one night. Nina, who looked like Britney Spears and talked like Courtney Love, was my favorite bartender. She was waving her hand in front of my face to interrupt or disrupt whatever the hell it was she thought I was doing. I clearly made her uncomfortable, curious, or both. "Huh? What?" I replied, snapping out of it. "Where do you go when you go?" "You do it a lot." She whipped her body around, putting her back against her side of the bar and faced away so she could see what I saw, trying to make sense of it. What could have possibly have held my attention for that long? A cash register, a few bottles of Wild Turkey, a Budweiser poster with bikini models? "Nowhere, just in my own head," I told her. "Anything good up there?" she asked, while pointing a straw between my eyes that she'd just pulled from her own mouth. Now, this wasn't so much a question as a cheeky comment. She wasn't really asking and didn't really want to know. This wasn't an opportunity for a moment. She wasn't trying to connect or help me through whatever it was I was going through. She wasn't flirting. It was a perfect opportunity for me to deflect and throw some fun comment back, which is what I usually did instead of actually saying anything from the heart. Just be fun. You can fake fun, I thought, while taking way too long to answer. "No, there's nothing good up there," I said in a rare moment of honesty. Her eyebrows shot up to her hairline. "You fucking idiot," I thought to myself. "You want another one?" she asked with a half smile while grabbing my empty pint glass. I nodded and opened my notebook and started writing to at least give the impression I knew what I was doing, to not look so bad for business. "Hope dies last," I wrote. When is all this finally going to knock me on my ass, I'd ask myself. When's it going to hit? When am I going to be normal? I wanted so bad to cry myself awake and drink myself to sleep. So I waited. I waited for the sadness to creep or even jackhammer its way in. I didn't know much, but I knew the way I was grieving couldn't be right. It sure as shit didn't feel right. I wondered if I was just really bad at it, or maybe, just maybe, really bloody good at it. Maybe this was my thing. Maybe letting people go was my superpower. After all, I'd long been more than fine to let friends go. Great friends. Friends that I told secrets to that I'd never say to anyone else. I was in my late 20s by now, and my closest friend was someone I'd met 3 years earlier, if that. My childhood relationships had all expired or run their course, and I never thought about any of those people. Ever. "What do you call a fish with no eye?" Nina asked, holding my drink off to the side until I answered. "I don't know. What?" I gave her enough of a beat to deliver whatever was coming next. I've always had respect for a good joke and would never think of stomping on someone's punchline. "Fshhh," she answered with wide eyes and a huge smile. She gave me the same look parents give to their kid when they try to cheer them up after they bonk their head on the edge of the counter. "Don't spend too much time up there," Nina added as she slid my fresh pint glass across the bar. "You gotta get out of your head sometimes. Give yourself a break." I hadn't cried since the funeral, and here I was months, maybe even a year later, and still nothing. I wasn't in shock. I was just vacant. My body was built for resilience, not grief. Maybe I got this from my old man, or maybe it was the same defense mechanism I'd unknowingly used over the years. I wasn't sure. I wasn't proud of how I was dealing with it, and I certainly didn't think I was tough. I was embarrassed. I read every room I walked into and overanalyzed every conversation around me so I could look and sound like someone who was still struggling, because that's what you're supposed to do when you're in the net. My mom was just as lost as I was, but she had it 10 times worse. I still don't know how she did it. 6 months after my dad died, her dad died, which meant she had to move my grandmother from Montreal to live with her in Acton. My nan was your classic, petty, passive-aggressive, sweet but bitter, English-speaking Montrealer, and now the two of them were mourning their husbands under the same roof. I'm still surprised they didn't kill each other. Nan was a retired nurse who raised four kids on her own before meeting and marrying the man who was the only father my mom ever knew. My mom's birth father died in a work accident when she was three, leaving my grandmother alone to raise my mom and her three older brothers during their teenage years. Nan loved a good joke, a lovely ham, canned peas, and a boiled potato. But if you ever asked what was for lunch, you'd only ever get one of two guaranteed answers: shit on a stick or cow's cocks and dandelions. Nan was funny, but she also held grudges and was a master manipulator. She made sure my mom knew how much she hated being there with her after their husbands died. My mom did it alone, all of it, and never asked anything from anyone. At home, she was dealing with more than any one person should ever be expected to, fighting back tears and fighting for air every second of her day, but she never complained or once felt sorry for herself. She never let it show. We were the same. Not long after Dad died, the phone calls stopped. People, other couples, and friends from church, people my parents had been tight with over the years, cut her off. There was no support system. Nobody wanted the widow at the barbecue. "Screw them," she told me on the phone one night. "I'm sick of this." She packed up my grandmother and everything she owned and moved out east to Newfoundland, leaving the small town where she'd spent her entire adult life, the same small town where she had just buried her husband. If she was going to be alone, she was going to do it in a town where she didn't know anyone. Taylor and I were back together, but not living together. I fought like hell to keep our marriage going, not because I thought we were great, but because I was afraid of being judged if it ended. That I'd be accused of only keeping her around long enough to get me through my dad's death. That I used her just for the support. And I felt I'd somehow be betraying my dad if I ended it. He really loved Taylor and was one of the only people who truly believed we'd last. We instinctively do our best to avoid judgment. This is especially true of how we act after someone we love dies. I hear these stories all the time when people call into the radio show or write me on social media looking for advice. Someone loses the love of their life and they're wondering when it's okay to move on and maybe even fall in love again. How much time is enough time? When is it okay to be normal? Because I've spent years seeing only the worst in people, when I go looking for it, I always find it. When someone overlaps grief with new love or happiness a little too soon, even friends of friends you hardly know become pearl-clutching, judgmental assholes. Okay, how long is enough then? When is it okay to dance again? How long do you think someone needs to be alone before you stop questioning if the love they lost was real or not? I felt that pressure, that same pressure felt by all those people who have reached out to me over the years. Like we have to perform, like we have to do grief, but not go too fast. I hadn't accepted or processed anything. I dressed for a funeral, I refused to let myself remember, and I chose isolation, in my own head and at the end of a bar. Nothing mattered. This wasn't the healthiest way to deal with it, but nothing I ever did was the healthiest way of doing anything. I wrote Nina's fish joke in my notebook, ripped out the page, and stuffed it in my pocket. That was the only thing I ever took home with me from that bar. Last call. Have just enough to drink to be able to do it, but not enough that anyone could tell. That's how I hosted my first TV show. Every night. Last Call was a live late-night experiment that lasted less than a year and was so bonkers that people still bring it up with me today. Seriously, it was on the air for maybe 7 months, and 20 years later, people still ask me about it. It was a wild, drunken disaster created by wild, drunken disasters. We shot the show in an actual working bar every weeknight at 11. I'd sit with a fake bartender and a few other hosts and talk shit about the day's headlines, interact with the actual customers, and interview whichever celebrity had a publicist insane enough to book their star client on our show. The Globe and Mail described it as a bunch of C-list celebs chatting in a bar about their C-list lives and an hour of tedium with a trio of hosts most would walk a block to avoid drinking with. An instant classic. I had no business being on that show. I didn't have any confidence, and I'd never hosted anything my entire life. The only things I had going for me was that I was a great producer, a better writer than most, and I didn't give a fuck. Most nights, that last one really showed. I was ticking like crazy, and my stage fright was so bad that earlier that year, when I was asked to say a few words at a friend's wedding, I had such incredible panic attacks that I lay down in the back seat of the cab the entire way there. I strapped one seatbelt around my upper half and the other one I wrapped twice around my legs, convinced I was going to pass out and hit the floor if the driver stopped too quickly. I couldn't catch my breath and I reconsidered that entire friendship the whole way to the church. But there I was, not long after that, on live TV, on a show that bothered people so much. One viewer turned up and sat at the bar for the entire taping with the sole intention of attempting to smash a thick bottom cocktail glass over my head when I walked off set. I was pulling in $55,000 a year, making me, without question, the lowest paid host in the history of late night television, and I was almost disfigured by a weak arm fan with bad aim in my second month on the job. "Hey, fucker, fuck you!" he yelled right before the glass went flying by my face, and one of the bartenders, a real one, not our TV one, tackled him to the ground. I don't know whether I just have a punchable face or what I was doing to rub people the wrong way, even on TV, but I felt like that glam kid again, that skid whose hair was too long, legs too skinny, wearing homemade costumes and yesterday's eyeliner. The shit magnet, always running away from a fight in jeans with no give and shoes with no grip. I didn't want to be hated, and most nights I did really try to do a good job. But no one needed me to do a good job. They just needed me to do all the crazy shit nobody else was willing to do. And if I could do it wearing only bikini bottoms, then even better. Anything for a laugh, and that's what people had a problem with. There's a pretty sizable part of the population that hates seeing other people having really dumb fun, especially when they're getting paid for it. It bothers them because it's not them. That's why Instagram influencers and TikTok stars are as hated as they are loved. I look like somebody else's waste of money. But with me, on that show, people skipped right past jealousy and went straight to rage. I'd roll into the station at 10 every morning, sit through a few story pitch meetings, and say yes to doing whatever crazy ideas they had. I never refused anything. Can you review The Passion of the Christ, but as a comedy? Like with a laugh track? Sure, of course. No problem. Then can you sneak your way into the Liberal Party convention and ask the party members embarrassing questions, like about sex and stuff? But don't be too blatant. Don't let them know it's about sex. We'll take care of that in editing. Does that make sense? Of course it does. Like butt stuff, but not really butt stuff. Do you want me to wear my bikini bottoms or my regular clothes? Maybe wear a suit there, but have the nut huggers underneath. Done. My mom didn't care what I did. She just cared about the hours I worked and the amount of sleep I didn't get. While working this show, I'd fall asleep around 2 a.m. and be up at 7. Mom was terrified that I was going to work myself into the hospital, like I did when my lungs collapsed. Whenever I checked in with her, she always ended our conversations the same. "Okay, hon, just don't work too hard. You can tell these people no sometimes." I could hear her using every ounce of mom restraint she had. "I know, Mom, but the only reason they keep me around is because I'm the guy who doesn't say no. I'll try, I promise." I broke that promise every time. After the morning meetings and a full day of writing, producing, and shooting stories, we'd all have from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. free before we had to be across town to shoot the live show at the bar. That's when the most talented crew of people I've ever worked with would head to a pub and get more drunk than I've ever seen people get, yet still be able to do their jobs. All of us, every night. The show's main advertiser was a beer company, which meant during the show, the hosts were expected to drink or at least pretend to drink their beer on air. I hated beer, so just outside of camera view, I always had a double vodka soda in a pint glass to pound during commercial breaks. Everybody who worked on that show had a drink within reach. I had two. I went in every night, sat at that bar, and did the best I could. I wanted so desperately to make somebody proud. That's what I lost when my dad died, and what I missed the most. The person who was always most proud of me was no longer with me. He would have loved all the crazy shit I did on that show. I'm pretty sure Taylor hated the show. She didn't say as much, but she also never brought it up. I actually don't remember much about our marriage, but I remember how much it bothered me that she never asked me about the show, and I don't have one single memory of her asking how my day went. We never fully agreed on art or entertainment or what it meant to have a voice and a platform or what you put out to the world, but I had a pretty good handle on what she thought was shit. Everybody likes doing foolish things, but nobody wants to look like a fool doing them. And I started to get a sense that Taylor thought she married a fool. I remember feeling like I'd let her down. It still kills me that all these years later, this is what I remember of our marriage. I have no memory of us doing normal married couple things. I don't remember us ever cooking dinner together or having a favorite show that we'd never miss. I don't remember what I'd get her for her birthdays or when we stopped having sex. I can't say for sure that my doing this show had anything to do with why Taylor and I broke up for good, but I can't say for sure that it didn't either. We went through too much too soon. Our marriage started with most people we knew wishing us luck, but telling us to our faces that they didn't think it would last. I probably spent more time trying to prove them wrong than I did trying to be a good husband. Proving people wrong was always what drove me. I think maybe I held on for too long because I knew that if my marriage ended, then I'd never be able to put my dad's death fully behind me. If I met someone new, even years later, they'd want to know his story just to be a part of my life. But I couldn't see myself ever wanting to retell or relive any of it. I spent the days leading up to the night we ended our marriage coming to terms with the fact that maybe this was it. Maybe this would be my last actual relationship. This was my rock bottom. You always hear stories of people's rock bottom. That last bender, huge loss, or catastrophic mistake. My rock bottom was different. My rock bottom, my lowest point, was when I came to terms with the fact and convinced myself that I was okay with never becoming a father. I couldn't see myself ever getting married again. The risk was too high, and I didn't have anything left. I remember the night we broke up, like officially, but I have no idea why it was that night as opposed to any of the others. The conversation happened in our bed, fully clothed, lying on top of the blankets with both of us staring up at the ceiling. We never made eye contact, and neither of us fought for a single thing. We didn't so much end our marriage as we let it go. Even today, if anyone asks what happened or why we split, the only answer I give is, sometimes you need a whole lot more than love to make a marriage work. We loved each other with everything we had, but it wasn't enough. It was never going to be enough. Nothing was ever going to be enough again. Look for the helpers. Have you ever met someone who is so much like you it's frightening? I'm not talking about someone who looks like you or does the same job or grew up where you did. I'm talking about someone who is exactly like you. These people never seem to walk into your life when you're at your best. They always find you at your worst. In those moments when you're stuck and feeling like everyone else is running at a different speed or moving in a different direction, or when you can't tell if you're on the outside looking in or right in the middle without anyone noticing you. I've spent a lot of time in that very spot. That's where I met Reagan. Now, the best thing you can do when you're there, when you're lost, is to follow Mr. Rogers' advice and look for the helpers. This quote, as well as his song, "What Do You Do With the Mad That You Feel," go viral every couple of years, usually after a school shooting or something else equally heartbreaking and inexplicable. His helper's quote goes like this. When I was a boy and I would see scary things in the news, my mother would say to me, "Look for the helpers. You will always find people who are helping." To this day, especially in times of disaster, I remember my mother's words, and I am always comforted by realizing that there are still so many helpers, so many caring people in this world. But what if the disasters are happening inside you? We can't claw our way out when everything is spinning so fast, so we stand still and convince ourselves that this is now our life. Maybe it's what we built, or maybe what we deserve. Maybe we're just broken, and we need to get on with accepting that. This is when you need the helpers. Helpers will make a difference. What won't make a difference is if you find someone exactly like you, someone in the same fucked up spot. These people are bad for you. They feel glorious, and for the first time in a long time, you'll feel whatever normal used to feel like, but they're so very bad for you. I didn't want help, and I didn't need a friend. I needed a partner, someone to race to the bottom with, someone who also believed the world was a cult of cruelty and full of monsters because they'd fought them too. Someone with scars and secrets. That's who Reagan was. She and I would meet at a filthy diner up the street from me at 9 a.m. on the weekends and start drinking. The diner didn't sell alcohol that early, but Reagan had a way of convincing anyone to do anything, especially when it came to breaking rules. So they'd serve us secret beer and coffee mugs with our breakfast, and we rarely paid for any of it. She was magnetic and wild, and I just wanted to be around her. Everybody did. Reagan was an expert at getting people to do all the things they never would, good or bad, humiliating or exhilarating. But when you were doing them, you never felt manipulated or taken advantage of. You felt free. I felt free. She was another vice, another distraction, but I loved who I was when I was around her. Nothing mattered, and we used each other. There's a power in irresponsibility, a freedom. It gives off the sense that you have nothing to lose, and that's an intoxicating quality to certain people. Living without consequences can be goddamn sexy. Reagan and I would drink from early morning until after midnight, getting lost in heady conversations and co-commiseration. Then we'd jump in her borrowed minivan, drunk, and she'd sideswipe a half dozen parked cars all the way down the narrow one-way street around the corner from my house. This went on most weekends, just the two of us, hammered, cheating death, and pouring our guts out to each other. It was all so incredibly self-indulgent, yet validating. "Do you think you feel things differently than other people?" she asked one morning in that diner, drinking beer out of mugs. "I don't know what I feel. Sometimes I don't even know if I do feel." If I didn't play the part, I knew she wouldn't want to hang with me anymore. So I told her what I thought she wanted to hear. She looked at me like I was special, broken, and fucked, but she somehow made me feel good about it, like I was doing everything right. "Do you want to feel?" Reagan grabbed my hand, laid it flat on the table, took a long drag off her cigarette, then hovered the tip of it over the back of my wrist until my hairs curled and burned. "Do you feel that?" I couldn't tell if this was like a sex thing or if she thought this was helping, but I went with it. "No," I said, and that was the truth. I'd spent hundreds of hours locked in a bathroom burning myself, so the hot end of a Camel Light an inch above my skin didn't even register. "What about this?" She touched the end of the cigarette to my hand and quickly pulled it away. "No," I said again. I started to feel less like I was part of something and more like her plaything, like a toy. I'd been in this situation before, and I knew what to do. I became the thing she needed me to be. "How about now?" she asked, and she snuffed what was left of the cigarette out on the meaty part, right between my thumb and my index finger. The end of it sunk right in, and the skin turned black around the edges. I knew enough about burns to know this one was going to take forever to heal. "No," I said again, shaking my head without breaking eye contact. Maybe this was a sex thing. I couldn't tell if she had just fallen in love with me or lost all respect. She reached across the table, took my cigarette from between my lips, and took a long drag, put my other hand flat on the table, and did the same thing, only harder, and I helped her. I put my hand on top of hers to make sure she didn't flinch, to make sure she knew I felt nothing. She held my cigarette there until it was out. That was the last time anything hot ever touched my body in any sort of deliberate way. Half of me was pissed because I knew Reagan just ruined my favorite thing, my ritual. But the other half was relieved. I was done. A better story would have been that I got the help I so desperately needed or found a healthy way to deal with it through honesty and growth. But I didn't. These were my first burn scars that other people could actually see. And that's when everything changed for me. I don't exactly know why I stopped hurting myself, but I just did. I knew I needed to start actually feeling life, and this was step one of a million, but it was a damn good start. You can still see those scars almost 20 years later. I'm not embarrassed by them anymore, but I've never told anyone the truth about where they came from. I told my mother I got them from the broiler when I reached into the oven and the door came back up and slammed my hand inside. "You got the clumsiness from me," she said. I told my coworkers the burns were from a hot motorcycle engine or my barbecue, and I even used fishing as an explanation when I was bored one day in a car with a cameraman. How the hell do you burn yourself fishing? He asked. You've never been fishing with me, I answered. These were all lies. Addicts lie, and I was a liar. I used humor to get me out of most awkward situations because I was in a constant state of pain and anxiety. Hurting myself was an addiction. I was addicted to using physical pain for emotional release. It was my way to deal with and ease all the awful stuff inside. The psychological pain. There's a romantic, almost punk rock aspect to seeing yourself as a weirdo or an outsider. Living on the margins by force or by choice can be wonderful, but you can't stay there. You have to have the courage to grow. And that first step is always the hardest. Life is about choices, my dad always used to say. Sometimes you're going to make the good ones, sometimes the bad ones. Just don't beat yourself up too hard over the bad ones. We all make bad ones. But the worst thing you can do after you really screw up is not ask for help. My old man was certainly no Mr. Rogers, but I knew exactly what he meant. I'm not saying that all of this was a choice, because for most of us, the ones who hurt to not hurt, it's not. But not asking for help was. For anyone who self-harms, as I did for half my life, you owe it to yourself to exhaust all your options when it comes to help. There's an end to it, and your world is filled with helpers. They want to help. Let them. All the money in the world. My pops never saw me on TV or heard me on the radio, which kills me. I was never the last thing he watched before bed or the first thing he listened to in the morning. But even back then, he knew I worked hard, too hard most days. Years before he died, Dad could already tell I was letting life get away from me. Don't forget to pump the brakes, he'd tell me. Work is work. It's the thing we all gotta do, but it can't be your everything. It doesn't mean you can't do a good job, but it can't be the thing you love or hate the most in life. That's what your friends and family are for. I don't remember my dad ever once coming home and complaining about work. I'm not saying the job or the people didn't ever drive him nuts, but he never wore it home. He was never emotional about work. He was efficient, dependable, and always on time. He didn't love it, but he was damn good at it. You can work your entire life for a company, every goddamn day, he'd say. Then, on a routine checkup, your doctor will tell you, sorry, Mr. Weston, you've got an ass full of cancer. Then what? That job you just killed yourself for is going to seem pretty insignificant. And what have you been doing this whole time? For what? For who? Don't forget to pump the brakes. Your job shouldn't be the thing you look most forward to in your day. Save your best for the people who matter the most. They can pay you all the money in the world, but none of it will mean squat. I'd like to say I took my dad's advice, but I so obviously didn't. I mean, the part about not getting emotional or letting my identity get too tied up in the job came easy. I've spent most of my adult life doing what a lot of people would consider dream jobs. Playing on TV, hanging with celebrities, traveling the world. But I've never used those two words, dream job, to describe what I do. I've never said I loved any job I've had or told anyone this was something I've wanted to do ever since I was a kid, like it was some sort of boyhood dream come true. For the most part, I've kept work and the people I work with on the outside. I wanted to see how far I could get in the industry without having to buy into the community. I refused to kiss anyone's ass, schmooze, or network. I wanted to do this all on my own, with no help, and I became obsessed with success, and not just my own. If I overheard a coworker talking about how their husband, who worked at a bank, got a promotion, I'd be infuriated. It would bother me all day. I'd obsess about it. I never felt like a victim or that anyone was holding me back or was out to get me. I just couldn't stand the feeling of not doing enough, like there was someone else out there, at a bank, working harder than me. My jealousy was fueled by incredible feelings of inadequacy, and it was impossible for me to acknowledge, let alone celebrate, whatever success I had. It was never enough. For my whole life, I felt like I was running on an alternate timeline to everyone else. Although I was the same age as the other kids, I seemed to go through all the big growing up bits way before anyone else. But all that was starting to shift by this point, and I began to feel I was being left behind. I was turning 30, and I was working my first on-air job, which is super late in that world. I was no longer the young kid with the big future. Suddenly, I was the late bloomer. This was the early 2000s, and the industry was exploding. People who did what I did, playing on TV, were getting incredible opportunities in America. There was a pipeline of talent flowing from Toronto down to the U.S. to work for MTV, VH1, E!, and just about every other cable network that needed a snarky, talking head with cool hair. I was all those things too. But I didn't know the first thing about finding a job in the States, and I refused to ask anyone for advice. I didn't want anyone to ever know what I wanted in case it never happened. I couldn't stand the idea of anyone knowing I'd failed. 7 months after it debuted, the network canceled Last Call, the bar closed, and I didn't have to get drunk at work anymore. Most of the production crew and I were moved over to the station's new entertainment show called The A-List, which was very much like Access Hollywood, only without the access. This was before TMZ, social media, and gossip blogs, and we were doing Perez Hilton-level shit talk before Perez Hilton was even a thing. The show was stacked with talent, and I was doing a ton of celeb interviews. This was another one of those dream jobs that made me miserable. My skin would crawl every time I walked into that building. It wasn't enough. I needed more. I always needed more. I was pretty sure my new boss hated me, and I was more than sure I didn't like him either. But we got along in a weird way, like two people forced to collaborate on a common goal that's mutually beneficial, like two divorced parents who vowed to not screw up their kid, so they suck it up and make it work. My boss and I had this thing, this show in common, and we were both determined to use it as leverage for the next opportunity. I needed him, he needed me, but fuck did we ever not get along. He didn't know it yet, but he was also my ticket to America. I spent months researching New York talent agents. Then I paid a video editor who worked on our show $100 cash to cut together a demo reel for me of the best of what I had. I remembered someone saying that agents never watched anything past 4 minutes and usually decided within the first 30 seconds whether they wanted to work with you or not. My demo reel was 3 minutes and 58 seconds, and the first thing you saw was me wearing only a pair of super small, super shiny black bikini bottoms, strapped to a bench, getting whipped by North America's third best dominatrix. I'm not sure how one becomes a third best dominatrix, but it was great television. That, by the way, was one of 4 clips of me doing crazy shit in bikini bottoms that I included on my demo. There was also a clip of me interviewing Paris Hilton, another one with Pauly Shore, and a few seconds in the studio from one of the rare times I'd be allowed to host the show, and not much else. It was a killer edit, and it moved fast as hell. Was I proud of it? No, not really, but people loved it, and that's all that mattered. I sent that package to 12 New York agents. 6 got back to me, and 4 of those wanted to set up meetings. I couldn't afford the flight, so I had to wait for my boss to send me to New York to do interviews for our show. That way, I'd be able to piggyback on the work trip and get him to pay for the whole damn thing. One meeting lasted less than 3 minutes. One agent didn't show up. Another one turned me away while I was still sitting in the lobby. I'd been sitting in the waiting area for about 10 minutes when he walked out of his office to introduce himself. I stood up and did all the right things. "Hang here for another 5 minutes," he said, while looking me up and down, but pretending to check his watch. "I'll be right back with you." He disappeared back into his office. 25 minutes later, someone else walked out and told me I could leave. "Do you want me to come back later?" I asked. "I can change my flight, no problem." "No, that's okay," she told me, really stretching out that no part. However, the 4th agent loved me and wanted to sign me on the spot. That's how the agent game works. Three will think you're shit and maybe even tell you to your face all the things wrong with you. Then one guy likes you so much, they prep the paperwork even before you arrive. This agent, the one who liked me, ran a mid-level shop out of a tiny office on Lexington Avenue and had helped a few Canadians deal with the immigration and visa stuff in the past. He knew what he was doing. He was around my age, had thin hair, and was much shorter than me, but his suit was incredible. Two-button, single-breasted, and custom as hell. I'd never seen that color blue in my entire life. The dude looked like he loved money. His clothes were beautiful, but his desk was a disaster. He had all the paperwork already out, propped right on the top of a huge stack of files and headshots, ready for me when I walked through the door. I signed on the spot. He talked like a New York agent from the movies. Love the stuff with the whipping, the dominatrix stuff, he beamed. Really edgy, really real. I could tell he'd only watched the first 30 seconds of my demo, but I didn't care. We can make money together, he said. We're going to make some good money together. We shook hands and I skipped across town to do the interviews for the show I was currently working for, then hopped on a quick flight back to Toronto. I didn't say anything to anyone, not even my family. 2 months later, I had my first big-time American TV job offer in Orlando, friggin' Florida. It's a morning show they're building, a brand new show, my agent told me. They're looking for four hosts, and they really like you. No crazy sex stuff, but they liked your interviews. You have to believe me when I say that even though this was Orlando, this was just about the most flattering thing anyone had ever said to me. It charged me up. I racked up more confidence on this one phone call than I'd felt in years. This was the validation I was looking for. It was pure, and I did it all on my own. But Orlando? It's a syndicated show, which means it will be national, my agent continued. Okay, go on, I thought. Now we're talking. Syndicated to small and medium markets throughout the states. So no New York, no LA, no Chicago or Dallas. He went on and on in detail about all the cities the show wouldn't be in. But still, this was America, my way in. I just needed to get there. This is what people do. Go down with a job offer, have someone else take care of all the visa and immigration nonsense, crush it, and hunt for the next opportunity. That had been the plan for years. I needed this. I've dealt with this team before, my agent said. They've produced a ton of syndication, and they're really great with moving expenses. People tend to not want to move to Orlando, so they'll take care of everything, put you up for a few months, and they pay well too. Before I could even ask, he added, we can negotiate, but you're probably looking at something in the $250-$275 range. He was so casual about it, like a $275,000 a year offer was normal to him, and it probably was. To me, this was more money than anyone had ever made in the history of my family. I felt like I somehow owed it to every single one of them to jump at this. To me, this was all the money in the world. Even if I went down for 2, maybe 3 years, I could live like a king in friggin' Orlando and still send enough money back home to Rich so he wouldn't have to carry our mortgage without me. I could even double up on payments and pay that sucker off years before we thought we ever could. This job and all that money would kickstart our future in a way I could never have dreamed. Think about it, my agent told me. We have a little bit of time. Let me know when you can jump on a quick call with them, then we can get you on a flight down to meet them. But they're really into you, so I think we have some power here. This was a shit ton to take in. It took me 3 days to even get over the shock of it all. And when that happened, when the shock wore off, it took me about one hot minute to decide I wasn't taking the job. There was no way. I didn't want to call them or fly down or even see how high we could negotiate that number. I didn't want to know because the number didn't matter. I wasn't going. My agent was pissed. He begged and did that agent manipulation thing they all do, trying to get me to at least talk to the Orlando people, to hear them out, to wait for a formal offer in writing before deciding anything. After all, there was a ton of money on the line here. No, I told him. No, thank you. That was the last time I ever talked to that agent. I never told anyone about the Orlando offer or how much I turned down. It was like it never happened. I didn't want to be alone. I've never wanted to be alone. That's the simple and from the heart truth. That's why I turned down that kind of payday. How long would it be before I made even one friend down there? I couldn't come home to an empty house. I've never come home to an empty house. I couldn't work those hours up at 3 a.m., crazy long days, and work that hard to not have anyone to share it with. I couldn't do that, any of it. Rich was my anchor. I still hadn't processed Pop's dying, and I was scared I might crack. What if all the stuff I had stacked came crashing down? What if I needed my brother, and he wasn't there? There was an emptiness in me that for years I filled with self-destruction, self-loathing, and self-harm. But loneliness was what I really feared. I couldn't be alone, not for all the money in the world. 4. Heart-shaped tattoo. 1984. The first concert I ever went to was in the summer of 84. It was June 26th, the third night of Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA tour down at the CNE Grandstand in Toronto. It was hot as hell that evening, but it was an outdoor show, so every now and then, you'd catch a quick, cool lake breeze that would blow through your hair and give you a couple short seconds of relief. We lived about an hour outside the city, so going in for a concert downtown was more like an adventure than it is now. You left early, and you made a day of it. It was magical. This show was just 3 days before Bruce released the video for Dancing in the Dark, the one where Courtney Cox was planted at the front of the stage and got pulled up near the end to dance not in the dark with Bruce. The video where we all fell in love with her and had no idea that she was actually hired to be there until years later. Dancing hit at the midway point of the show that night. It was the 15th song Bruce played, 2 songs after Born in the USA and 10 before Born to Run. I was 9, about to turn 10 in the fall, and the summer of 84 is what defined so much of who I am today. I don't think you forget those magical summers when you're 9, 10, and 11. Those are your peak kid years, when you maybe kiss a girl for the first time, get into your first fight, fall in love, or get that ticket stub from your very first concert. That was the first night I ever got lost dancing in a crowd full of strangers, and the first time I saw another human being stand on a stage and have absolute control over the bodies and emotions of 30,000 people. Not only was 1984 the most magical year of my youth, it was the most significant and incredible year in pop culture history, and that's a hill I will die on. In 1984, I went to the third night of Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA tour and became a legend among my classmates. My dad's coworker, Penny, had become more like a family friend. She'd been to our house a few times, and I remember her being a little younger than my parents. She was cool and pretty, and she always talked to me about the music I was into. My parents really had zero interest in what I liked, so I was always happy when we'd see Penny. She lived in a fancy high-floor apartment close to the city, and every now and then, Dad and I would drive out there so they could hang out together. I was totally blown away by her balcony when we arrived. "Can I go out there?" I remember asking. I'd never been in a condo before or on a balcony. "Sure, of course you can." Penny set me up on the balcony with her portable tape player and a stack of her cassettes, and I burned through Born in the USA as many times as I could before my pops dragged me in because it was time to leave. Penny's apartment was exactly how you'd picture a modern 80s condo. Glass block divider wall between the kitchen and living room, white metal spiral staircase up to the bedroom, and a built-in and fully stocked bar with 4 high-back dusty rose stools. I loved it there. Another time we went, another Saturday afternoon, I was allowed to swim in the pool off the back of Penny's building while she and my dad hung out upstairs. On about our 3rd or 4th visit, I remember Penny and my dad in the kitchen pouring bottles of alcohol down the sink. I looked over at the bar, and it was empty. All the bottles that were there the last time were now on the kitchen counter. I didn't know what the hell was going on. Why would they do that? Maybe the booze had gone bad. I do remember Penny crying that day. She was sad, an absolute mess, and my dad was trying to console her and calm her down by rubbing her back and whispering in her ear. I felt bad for her, but stayed in the living room with my back to the kitchen, still wet from my swim, trying not to make too much noise. I could see everything going on behind me through the reflection in her TV. She was having a rough day, and I wished she wasn't. "Hey, Roz," Penny yelled to me as soon as she walked out of the kitchen, wiping tears from her eyes. "You ready to have the best day of your life?" "Yeah, okay," I said. My dad was still in the kitchen, leaning against the counter, putting tops back on empty bottles. Penny grabbed her purse off the coffee table, dug her hand down to the bottom of it, and pulled out a small white envelope. "Here," she told me, "these are for you. For us, actually," and handed it over. I opened it up and pulled out 3 concert tickets. I'd never seen a concert ticket before, so I didn't really know what I was looking at. "What is it?" I asked her. "Bruce Springsteen," she explained. "Tickets to his concert. It's in 3 weeks, and your dad said I could take you and your brother. The 3 of us will go together." To be honest, I didn't fully understand how concerts worked. Like, was Springsteen coming here? "Yes, Springsteen is coming here, and we're going to see him, live." "Will they have t-shirts?" I asked. I don't remember why that was such a concern, but it was the only question I could think to ask. Concert shirts were the only thing I knew about concerts. "Yeah," she said and laughed. "They will definitely have t-shirts, and we can definitely get you one." I spent the next few weeks bragging to all my friends that I was going to a concert and that it was Bruce friggin' Springsteen. None of my friends had ever done anything like that before. This was another one of those things that I did way before any other kid I knew. In the days and weeks after the show, I was a hero, an absolute legend. I would be at a friend's house, and even their parents were jealous of me because they'd tried and failed to get tickets to one of Springsteen's 3 nights in Toronto. I knew all the songs in order. I told them how he started with Badlands and ended the night with a cover of Twist and Shout by the Beatles. I told them how I danced on my chair and screamed until I had no voice left. I told them about how incredible our seats were, 3rd row floors, just off to the left, and that I was pretty sure Bruce pointed at me, but I was definitely sure Clarence Clemons did. I remember telling anyone who asked that, yes, I did get a t-shirt, but I forgot it in the bathroom after the show, and I was pissed about it because it was $25. I told everyone everything. I've told this story for almost 40 years. I've told it to friends. I've told it on the radio. I've gone into detail about that night on TV and mentioned it in interviews when anyone ever asked me what my first concert was. Hell, I even told Bruce himself that he was my first concert when I met him, briefly, on a red carpet years later. I had maybe 4 seconds with the man as he was ushered past me, and I told him he was my first. "That's really great, man," he told me. We shook hands, and he was gone. How many people get to do that? But it never happened. It's all bullshit. A lie. All of it. I never went to see Bruce Springsteen that night. I never danced on a chair, sang along, or lost my t-shirt. The tickets were real, that's for damn sure. But I didn't make it to the show because a week before it happened, my mom kicked my dad's ass out of the house because he was having an affair with Penny. He was cheating, they were fucking, and it broke my mom's heart and almost destroyed our family. I don't know exactly how he told her or how my mom found out, but I remember being up in my room and hearing my mom yell, "You're a hell of an actor, Ralph," as she slammed the door behind him. It had obviously been going on for a while. "Your dad's gone, and he's not coming back," she shouted up the stairs when I poked my head out of my room to see what was going on. I didn't know how to react. I didn't know what to do with sadness and rage. So I picked up a small metal shelf in my room and threw it into the beige wall over my bed, just to the left of my Lonnie Anderson poster. "No," I yelled as I grabbed it again and put 4 more holes in the drywall from the sharp feet on the bottom of it. Then 4 more holes. I pounded that thing as hard as I could, as many times as I could, until I fell back onto my bed next to my Chewbacca stuffy and cried into my hands. Out of all the things that happened in 1984, this is my most vivid memory. I have no recollection of seeing Ghostbusters in the theater, but I remember my mom calling my dad a liar and kicking him out. I didn't want to remember it because I didn't want it to be real. I wanted everything to be normal again. I didn't want my mom to cry. I wanted my dad back, and I didn't want to have to tell the other kids why I didn't get to see Bruce Springsteen. So I lied. The day after the show, I was riding my bike around Prospect Park, which was right across the creek from the old flour mill where Rich and I got our first jobs. Two older kids, maybe late teens, early 20s, were standing around and talking about the concert the night before. I rode circles around them without getting too close as they went on and on about how great the show was, and I memorized everything I overheard. Then I rode up to Ed's In-N-Out Variety and grabbed a copy of the day's paper that reviewed the show and printed the entire set list. I memorized that too. 28 songs, Dancing in the Dark was the 15th, 2 songs after Born in the USA, and 10 before Born to Run. That's all I needed to know. I hated my dad for doing this to me, for putting me in a position to lie for him, because the truth hurt too much to tell. So I lied. And I've lied about this for my entire life. Maybe because I've never told anyone about my dad's affair, and those two things are somehow tied together in that little part of my kid mind that still exists somewhere. Maybe I kept this story in the same place I kept that afternoon in the closet with that family friend, and the same place I put the possibility that I may have fathered a child when I was 13 going on 14. My dad broke the rules. He broke the rules of his marriage, of his workplace, and of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a long-standing rule in AA when it comes to sponsorship: the boys with the boys and the girls with the girls. That's the rule when someone sober is helping someone else through the early stages of their recovery. It's not an official rule, but it is